Today is Thursday, December 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. With the end of the year approaching, can a Brexit deal be reached?
Today, the EU chief negotiator, Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, he said, and I quote, right now it's a make or break moment.
Plus, the reaction in Hong Kong as pro-democracy leaders are sentenced to prison.
Time and again, Amnesty International had pointed out that the public order ordinance have provisions that are not up to international standards and laws.
We'll have these stories and more next. With less than a month to go before the end of the year deadline to seal the deal on trade between the European Union and Britain, Paris-based reporter Nicolas Pinault tells me Brexit talks are reaching a make-it-or-break-it point.
Yeah, you know, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, was clear earlier on Tuesday saying that he doesn't want a bad deal. So he's putting pressure on the EU negotiator, the Frenchman, Michel Barnier, to really have a good deal, I mean, on from the European perspective. And basically, President Emmanuel Macron, he said that France will not accept a Brexit that does not respect our long-term interests. So there's a long going on here, and for example, this Wednesday, the French Prime Minister Jean Castex is going to meet with French fishermen because we know it's a big issue in the current talks.
Speaking of fisheries, that's in waters near Britain, and Britain is the other party that must agree to a deal with the EU to finalize everything. So, you know, across the channel, what are people in London saying?
Well, they're quite optimistic that so far, with more than 3 weeks remaining before getting a deal by December 31st, you have the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who said Britain remain absolutely committed to trying to get a deal. If we can, that's what he said. You have David McAllister, who chairs a Brexit group in the European Parliament. He said on Twitter, swift progress is of the essence. And basically, in London, people are quite optimistic that a deal is still reachable within the time frame. But, you know, they've been talking for months now. So we still know that they hear some hard talks on the difficult topics that remain on the table.
Now, you're talking about, you know, trying to reach a deal before the end of the year. It's not just agreeing to terms. It's having to pass ratification in the EU with all the bloc members. So, you know, what are the prospects that that kind of time frame can be reached? And have there been any discussions about extending the talks or extending the agreement process past December 31st?
You're absolutely right. I mean, that's what worries the most on the European side, because you have EU members who are going to have to ratify it. And people in the EU Parliament, they also want to have a look at it. So today, the EU chief negotiator, Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, he talked to the state members talking about what he's talking right now with the British side. And he said, and I quote, right now it's a make or break moment. And he really said that he's keep talking. He didn't say that he might need a different date if there is a possible agreement so far. So, but it was being very cautious, because on the European side right now, there's a worry that Michel Barnier might want to try to rush a bad agreement with the UK.
So really quickly, Nico, what are the sticking points that are preventing both sides from reaching an agreement after all this time?
The fisheries, that's been one of the main headache for the Europeans. So basically what they would like is to give between 15 and 18% of the rights of and the values of all the fish taken into the UK seas from European fishermen. And of course, the UK would like to have 80% of their deal. Tonight, Barnier said that London would like to lower than its expectation and maybe only ask for 60%. And there's also a key talking point right now, and very difficult. It's the key playing field between both sides, because basically it's, you know, you have so many regulation between EU states, and right now the UK is part of the EU, and they want to keep that regulation going on after the Brexit, and they also want to make sure that the state aid that London might provide to its companies once the Brexit is acted, they're not going to turn into an unfair competition.
Nicolas Pineau reports from Paris, France. Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, says he is opposed to a bill approved by Parliament to suspend UN inspections and boost uranium enrichment, saying it would be harmful to diplomatic efforts. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma takes it from here.
The tug of war over the bill, which gained momentum after the killing of a prominent Iranian nuclear scientist last month, reflects the rivalry between Rouhani, a relative moderate, and hardline lawmakers who dominate the parliament and favour a more confrontational approach to the West. Speaking at a cabinet meeting, Rouhani said his administration does not agree with the bill and considers it harmful for the trend of diplomatic activities. He implied the lawmakers are positioning themselves ahead of elections planned for June. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Afghan government and Taliban representatives said on Wednesday they had reached a preliminary deal to press on with peace talks, their first written agreement in 19 years of war, which was welcomed by the United Nations and Washington. Reuters' Emer McCarthy reports.
The agreement comes after months of talks in Doha, which were backed by the United States, while the two sides are still at war. U.S. Special Representative for Afghan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad, said that the two sides had agreed on a three-page agreement codifying rules and procedures for their negotiations on a political roadmap and a comprehensive ceasefire. Taliban insurgents refused to agree to a ceasefire in the early stages of talks. Despite being ousted from power during the 2001 U.S. invasion, the Taliban still have control over wide areas of the country. Under a February deal, foreign forces are to leave Afghanistan by May 2021 in exchange for counterterrorism guarantees from the Taliban. U.S. President Donald Trump has looked to speed up the withdrawal despite criticism, saying he wanted to see all American soldiers home by Christmas to end America's longest war. The Trump administration has since announced that there would be a sharp drawdown by January, but at least 2,500 troops would remain.
That was Reuters reporter Emer McCarthy. Joshua Wong, one of Hong Kong's most prominent democracy advocates, was jailed on Wednesday for more than 13 months over an unlawful anti-government rally in 2019, the toughest and most high-profile sentence for an opposition figure this year. Reuters' Maha Albadrawi has the details.
The sentencing comes as government critics say Beijing is intensifying its crackdown on Hong Kong's opposition and wide-ranging freedoms, guaranteed by the 1997 handover of the former British colony. Authorities in China and Hong Kong reject that assessment. The protest in question, near Hong Kong's police headquarters last June, came when the city's sometimes violent pro-democracy rallies were already in full swing. Wong's longtime colleagues Agnes Chow and Ivan Lam were sentenced to 10 and 7 months respectively on charges linked to the same siege. Wong first rose to prominence during the city's pro-democracy umbrella movement in 2014, and his continued activism has drawn the wrath of Beijing. Wong disbanded his pro-democracy group Demosesto just hours after China's parliament passed a sweeping national security law for Hong Kong this summer. Under the new law, any activity Beijing considers subversion, secession, terrorism, or collusion could be punished by up to life in prison.
Maha Albadrawi reports for Reuters News. Following the sentencing, Amnesty International Hong Kong program manager Ming Lam criticized the government for carrying out the prosecutions he said were politically motivated.
Time and again, Amnesty International had pointed out that the public order ordinance have provisions that are not up to international standards and laws, given that it has a lot of restrictions on the applications for a peaceful assembly because it lends the police authorities to ban and prohibit processions and assemblies basing on reasons of national security or public security or other reasons. So with the public security law in the background, we are afraid that national security would be used more frequently as a pretext to ban assemblies, peaceful assemblies and processions, and hence to stifle Hong Kong people's right to freedom of expression.
Hong Kong was handed back to China from Britain in 1997 under the One Country, Two Systems Agreement, promising the city a high degree of autonomy until 2047. But in June, Beijing implemented the national security law for Hong Kong to curtail demonstrations. The law came into effect on June 30th of this year, prohibiting secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces, and its details can be widely interpreted. As Australia's diplomatic and economic relationship with China sinks to new lows, analysts believe the partnership can be repaired. Phil Mercer reports the two countries clashed over a tweet of alleged war crimes in Afghanistan shared by China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
China is engaging in a so-called tongue war against Australia as an example to other countries, according to analysts. Relations have deteriorated in recent years over allegations of Chinese interference in Australian politics and cyber espionage. There's been disagreement over Beijing's military expansion in the South China Sea and democracy in Hong Kong. Canberra's call for a global investigation into the origins of the new coronavirus, first detected in the Chinese city of Wuhan, was interpreted as an infuriating slight against China. Political tensions hit new lows Monday when China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs posted a doctored image of an Australian soldier holding a bloody knife to the throat of a child. It was a provocative reference to a recent report that detailed alleged atrocities perpetrated by Australian special forces in Afghanistan. Canberra angrily demanded an apology for the shameful tweet, but Beijing accused Australia of attempting to stoke domestic nationalism. Chinese diplomats said the rage and roar of some Australian politicians and media was an overreaction. Resetting ties with its biggest trading partner won't be easy for Australia. But experts believe that quiet, sensible diplomacy can eventually repair the damage, and that Australia shouldn't have reacted in such a combative way to China's war crimes tweet. Professor Jane Golly is the director of the Australian Centre on China in the World at the Australian National University.
Surely we don't want an enemy that is that strong and powerful in the world. You know, even if they're doing things at the moment that we really don't agree with or like, I'm going to continue to believe that there is scope for an engagement strategy that reduces the long-term risks and bringing benefits, you know, to the millions of people here and the billion or 1.4 billion over there as well. We're all humans after all, but I still don't think that that antagonistic approach is the best one for the years ahead.
Trade with China has underpinned Australia's recent prosperity. 40% of its exports have been sold to Chinese buyers, and Australia is a source of food and strategic minerals, including iron ore. But recent diplomatic disputes have coincided with China imposing tariffs and restrictions on a range of products, including wine, barley, beef and coal, that could cost Australia billions of dollars in lost revenue. China also warned its citizens not to travel or study in Australia because of fears of racism fueled by COVID-19. In 2014, former Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott said Australia-China relations were characterised by fear and greed. Phil Mercer, Sydney.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
From ostriches and emus to kiwis and penguins, scientists say that there are currently about 60 living flightless bird species in the world. There are many more species like the giant moa that became extinct over the years. A new study published in the journal Science Advances suggests that the number of flightless bird species would be quadrupled today if it weren't for human interference. The study, led by researchers from the University College of London, also proposes that flightlessness evolved more frequently in birds than was thought if extinct species along with current species were considered. To make their findings, the researchers put together a list of 581 bird species that have gone extinct from when our earliest human ancestors walked the earth until today. Of the 581 extinct birds, 166 of them weren't able to fly. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. British regulators approve the use of Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine, saying that a rollout will begin next week. But like his European counterparts, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government is scrambling to come up with a vaccine distribution plan and is having to answer key logistical and epidemiological questions, including who should be in the early waves to receive inoculations and how to ramp up mass immunization program able to vaccinate millions as soon as possible. Statistics tabulated by Johns Hopkins University in the United States shows over 64.3 million confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus that has caused nearly 1.5 million deaths globally. U.S. President Donald Trump posted a more than 45-minute video on social media, calling it perhaps the most important speech he's ever made.
I want to provide an update on our ongoing efforts to expose the tremendous voter fraud and irregularities which took place during the ridiculously long November 3rd elections.
President Trump alleged that the American election system was under coordinated assault and siege, a claim that was flagged as disputed by both Facebook and Twitter. Tuesday, U.S. Attorney General William Barr says that the Justice Department has not uncovered any evidence of widespread voter fraud and has seen nothing that would change the outcome of the 2020 presidential election won by Democrat Joe Biden. Barr said U.S. attorneys and FBI agents have been working to follow up on specific complaints and information they have received, but they've uncovered no evidence that would affect the final results. Former Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency Director Chris Krebs said the November 3rd election was the most secure in United States history, and state Republican and Democratic lawmakers have said they have found no evidence of widespread fraud that would change the result of the election. Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany spoke to reporters at the White House on Wednesday, answering questions why the president was pursuing his course of action despite no evidence of voter fraud, and battleground states have already certified their election results.
The president has said that he believes all legal votes should be counted and all legal votes should not be counted. And in fact, the campaign is pursuing that litigation. I can't get into the details of that litigation here, but they still do have active cases in Nevada and Wisconsin.
But how does he overturn the results when they've already been certified in these battleground states, Kayleigh?
Again, the president is just looking for every legal vote to be counted, and I will leave it to the campaign to pursue their end.
Court cases brought by the Trump campaign have repeatedly been dismissed by judges who have ruled the suits lacked evidence. McKinney also dismissed reports that the president had been discussing pardons after a court document said prosecutors said they expected to find evidence that certain individuals illegally acted as lobbyists to senior White House officials to secure a pardon or reprieve of sentence for someone whose name was also redacted in the document.
I've heard no mention of any pardons in any conversations I've had in the White House other than the pardon of Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, a three-star general who I've discussed from this podium before.
President Trump is also threatening to veto a major defense spending and policy bill unless it includes eliminating a law protecting internet companies from liability for material posted by its users.
The president is serious about it. And I noted, when you have other world leaders that are making calls for genocide and Twitter not finding that worthy of flagging or blocking. Beyond that, you look at China, who's putting out disinformation. China tweeted out, I believe it was 6 days ago, I think it was November 25th, that COVID-19 did not originate in Wuhan, something that was not deemed worthy of flagging by Twitter. There are real real grave concerns here, and the president stands by that. And it also is worth noting that the president will always defend our military, ensure that we get adequate defense funding, as he's gotten $2.9 trillion so far. But he is going to put the pressure on Congress to step up on this.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson gave me extra details.
So Section 230 is something that Republicans have been raising concerns about all throughout this year, particularly since it's been an election year. They have alleged that some of the large social media companies like Twitter and Facebook have discriminated against conservative viewpoints, and they've said that they've been censored on those social media platforms. They've even pulled in the CEOs of those companies to try and get some answers on that issue. And they've talked a lot about this Section 230, which many people may know is known as the law that built the internet, that allows free discourse online without those social media companies being held liable for the content that's posted on their platforms. Now, where we get into a little bit of trouble is the fact that the president is connecting these two issues. When you talk to a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill, they're saying that this issue should not be connected to the National Defense Authorization because this is such an important issue of national security.
Now, Catherine, both the House and the Senate have passed resolutions to fund the military. They're trying to iron out the differences before it is sent up to the White House to be signed into law. And provisions to change Section 230 is not in that bill. So what would happen if the president follows through on his alleged threat to veto it?
Well, what the first thing that would happen is that the military wouldn't receive its funding for the year until they could sort out some sort of deal with the president. Now, remember that the NDAA is so popular on such a bipartisan basis that it almost always passes with a veto-proof majority, meaning that it would then get kicked back to the U.S. Congress and they would be able to override the president's veto. So it's a little bit of a confusing moment here because ultimately the president is not going to be able to get what he's saying he wants to get.
Now, Catherine, one last question while I have you on the phone. What are you hearing from those walking the halls of Capitol Hill about funding the government? Because currently, the spending authorization to keep the lights on, so to speak, of the U.S. federal government is only going to last a short while longer. What are they saying about the prospects of signing a new deal?
You know, we go through this pileup of legislative items every December. Every year at the end of the year, the things that the U.S. government needs to get funded and that need to be done that Congress should have been working on for the past couple of months all suddenly get jammed into these last few days in session when lawmakers want to fly back to their home districts, take that holiday break, take a breather before the new Congress starts. And they just leave everything for the last possible moment, in part because everything that's debated politically in the United States these days is so politically partisan and nobody wants to be the person who makes a deal or gives in. So instead, they wait until the absolute last deadline. And what I'm hearing is that they're really hoping that they can get something done, but it's not a sure thing. And that means that they're going to have to pass a continuing resolution, which is basically legislation that temporarily funds the government and then kicks this whole discussion into the new year so that they can go through it all over again.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Nearly 500,000 South Korean students are taking their all-important college entrance exam on Thursday. I spoke to reporter Jason Strother in Seoul via WhatsApp to learn how health and education officials are stepping up their efforts to prevent test sites from becoming coronavirus hotspots.
This year's college entrance exam, the Sunung, as it's called here in Korea, is like an unlike any other test that has been given. This is, of course, happening in the middle of the pandemic, and South Korea's education and health authorities are trying to prevent the 1,300 or so testing locations from becoming coronavirus hotspots. So for starters, all test takers, there's close to 500,000 of them today, have to wear masks. There are acrylic desk dividers between the test takers to limit the spread of any breathing in between the students. Windows are going to be kept open periodically to ventilate the room. Students are being told not to mingle during recess, and any student who had shown symptoms of COVID-19 or had tested positive in the previous days have been sent to special quarantined testing sites. There's around 86 or so of them around the country where they will be able to take the test in a more safe environment.
Jason, those are the plans, but have they encountered any problems on this day of testing?
Well, the Yonhap News Agency is reporting that a test examiner, a teacher, tested positive last night for COVID-19. So that teacher has been sent into quarantine, as is procedure here in South Korea. And Yonhap is reporting 14 other test examiners have also been sent into quarantine because they came into contact with that patient out of a precaution. The students will be taking the test for, they still have just some more hours left to go. Of course, Steve, this test is high stakes. It's widely seen as determining one's academic, professional, and even marital trajectory.
Right. And in years past, the streets lining up to the schools have been filled with fellow students, parents, people from society cheering on these students taking this college entrance exam. What's taking place this year?
The Ministry of Education has pretty much banned any cheering squads, and they have gently asked the parents not to wait around outside the centers.
Jason Strother reports from Seoul, South Korea. And finally, former French President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, who became a champion of European integration during his 1974 to 1981 presidency, has died at the age of 94. His office said on Wednesday night that he passed away at his family home after contracting COVID-19. Born in 1926, Giscard served in the Free French Army that helped liberate France during World War II. Charles de Gaulle named him finance minister at the age of 36. As president, Giscard d'Estaing helped forge a single Europe with his close friend, German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt. And together, they laid the foundation for a euro single currency. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a terrific Thursday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In an effort to generate new ideas that will help make development effective, the U.S. Agency for International Development's Global Development Lab has rolled out the Development Innovation Ventures program. It is a rolling system whereby anyone on any subject from anywhere in the world at any time can submit a good idea, said Executive Director of the Global Development Lab Bureau, Harry Bader.
And the lab will work with them. It is an evidence-based process where it is paid for performance at certain milestones, as well as capacity building and building up a non-traditional partner so that they are an equal contributor to the development in their own country or other countries.
Through the Development Innovation Ventures program, USAID is employing the private sector to develop effective solutions. Take, for example, Phoenix International, said Director Bader.
Phoenix will go out and they'll put a solar array on an individual person's home that can supply a certain amount of electricity over time during the course of a day. And if that person is able to pay that day, they can use their flip phone to let the base know that they've just deposited, let's say, 33 cents for that day's electricity usage. And then through their headquarters, they can contact a satellite where they can then beam down the switch that turns on the solar array. That is an amazing way to expand the use and access to electricity when you are off the grid.
In need of funds to scale up their operation, Fenix requested an investment from USAID. USAID came up with a grant of under $1 million. Fenix, now known as NG Energy Access, used that money to expand, invest even more money, and scale up its operations. And so we've created a model to solve a problem that helps corporate shareholders make money delivering a service that is so central, electricity and lights, that can help eradicate illiteracy because you can study, that remediates some of the issues with agricultural production and hunger, and that goes towards economic growth. Because one of the key aspects of eliminating extreme poverty is getting someone connected to the global digital infrastructure, said Director Bader. And this is something that can happen as a result of the model pioneered by Fenix, but which was funded in part at a critical moment by USAID's Global Development Lab.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.